Welcome back to Plot Pit, Forging Fiction from Fact and Folklore. I'm one of your hosts, William Atkinson, here with our second host,
John LeMay.
And we have very special guest, Jesse F. Lawrence, on the phone. Hello, Jesse. How are you?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Oh, we are fantastic today. Today, in the Plot Pit, we have...
We're going on spring break with mermaids.
Spring break and mermaids. Let's begin the descent. Jesse, introduce yourself and give us your socials for our listeners.
Hi, I'm Jesse. I'm a science fiction author. I've got 3 books out now, and you can find me on social networks from Twitter to Facebook to Reddit at JFL here, as in H-E-R-E, on most social networks.
Excellent. I'll have information in the description below for links to your socials as well as your books, iNano, The Day After Infinity, and Metal. Check this author out. He's got some really cool stuff out there. In the meantime, John, introduce us to Spring Break and Mermaids.
Sure. Well, first I'm going to apologize to Jesse because we have done subject matter in the past that would have been so perfect for Jesse, kind of dystopian future type stuff or the John Murray Spears God Machine. I feel like that would have been perfect for him. And here we are today talking about mermaids. But my reasoning partly was, you know, we like to keep it fresh. We like to mix it up. And also, by the time this episode is premiering, people should either be on spring break or thinking about spring break. I don't know which.
Yeah.
Mid-March? Yeah. Do you think we have any wild spring breakers listening to us, Will, or do you think they're more the older reserved crowd?
Well, I have looked at our geographical listenings, and we have people all over the world, including Australia.
Okay, well, I mean, we're not going to go to Australia today, but we are going to go to some nice sandy beaches in Florida with the mermaids and the coral castle. I think those are really the only two elements we're going to need to build a fascinating story. But we'll start with a real mermaid account from the year 1890. Story was entitled A Mermaid at Last, published in the Marion, Ohio Daily Star on May 13th, 1890. And it's a short little article. It's not too long, so we'll just read the whole thing.
Okay, so I just want to get this right. You're reading from a paper in Ohio about mermaids.
Yeah, well, you know, like, so one thing people have got to understand about these old articles, you know, you just like to attribute the source to the exact printing. So the story itself probably originated in Florida, and then a newswire in Ohio picked it up, and that's just the one that either myself or someone else found, you know what I mean? So
now, forgive me on my ignorance here. The Associated Press came around when? Early 1900s, late 1800s?
I can't actually answer that. But I mean, I know every old newspaper that I look at from the 1800s, they have stories from all across the U.S. in them.
Well, you'll remember our vampire story out of Chicago. That particular machine incident that sucked the guy dry, that got reprinted a few times across some of the papers.
Yeah.
So this isn't uncommon.
Sure. And same with the Tombstone Pterodactyl. You know, that was printed in all sorts of papers. So, I mean, there was definitely some form of the Associated Press back then. I mean, I guess maybe it wasn't attributed to that, but yeah. But anyways, yeah, so on to the mermaids. So story takes place in Florida. Article begins, a dispatch from Jacksonville, Florida, dated April 29th, 1890, says W.W. Stanton, mate of the schooner Addie Schaefer, while fishing for bass 300 miles off of St. Augustine, drew in his line and found entangled therein the strangest fish, if it is a fish, that has ever been caught. This strange creature is about 6 feet long, pure white, and scaleless. The head and face are wonderfully human in shape and feature. The shoulders are well outlined and very much resemble those of a woman, and the bosom is quite well defined and shows considerable development, while the hips and abdomen continue the human appearance. There are 4 flippers, 2 of which are placed at the lower termination of the body and give one the impression that nature made an effort to supply the strange creature with lower limbs. Mr. Stanton confesses to quite a fright on his first sight of his queer prize, which, on being drawn on board, gave utterance to a low moaning sound, which might easily have been mistaken for the sobbing of a baby. I do want to interrupt real quick, because I, as someone who investigates paranormal phenomena, I like to point out commonalities. And a commonality that I see is almost all supernatural creatures like skinwalkers and shapeshifters. They all make a crying noise like a baby. So that's just a weird commonality that all of these supernatural creatures have. So
then that's interesting. You know, me, as you know, I'm not an investigator of paranormal activity or anything. I do enjoy like ancient aliens and stuff like we've talked about and these old stories, but you've gone down the route mm-hmm. of investigating these strange stories specifically for a lot of your books.
Yeah.
And you're the correlation of crying like mm-hmm. a baby.
And this is something I have a feeling we probably won't use in the story, but it's just like I always say, some of our listeners enjoy this folklore stuff. So that's just something, you know, to file away in your memory bank. If you're interested in folklore, these supernatural creatures make noises like babies. And some people think it's to lure good-natured people out to wherever it is, and then that they'll take them away or kill them or whatever. But so anyways, maybe that's neither here nor there for the story we're going to concoct, but I just thought I'd throw that out there, but continue the article. It is extremely unfortunate that Mr. Stanton did not succeed in keeping the creature alive, which he thinks might have been done as the strange object lived 2 days after being taken. The schooner has been thronged all day by curious visitors who express much wonder and astonishment at the strange object. Mr. Stanton, after visiting several ports and showing his queer creature, donated it to the Smithsonian Institution. The fish or mermaid is in a large 6-foot glass in alcohol. And so I'll say something else. A lot of these articles always end with the mystery animal being shipped off to the Smithsonian. And of course, the Smithsonian never has these mystery animals, which means one of two things. The stories are made up, or the Smithsonian hides things.
Or, and maybe this is my conspiratorial mind just salivating on this, it is indeed a true story,
mm-hmm.
and the Smithsonian does not have it.
Mm.
The question is why?
Oh, we could play. Yeah, maybe that will play into our story.
We do know that the Vatican has some vaults.
Yeah.
That's the mystery.
Yeah, well, that might be all we need to make a story, but I'm going to throw in a second, even stranger concept, also from Florida, that I just think can tie in really well with mermaids. So this came up on a past podcast, and William was the one who brought it up, the Coral Castle. William, what do you remember about the Coral Castle just from your memory?
So I discovered, well, I wasn't the discoverer, okay, but the Coral Castle came known to me several years ago, and I was listening to a song by Andrew Peterson, who's a Christian musician. He has a song called The Coral Castle, and it's about this guy who goes down to the coast, and he's brokenhearted, his love doesn't want him, and he builds this massive castle for her, and part of the chorus is, "I don't need your love to love you all I can." And it's a very powerful, emotionally telling story that's kind of melancholy, but just heartbreaking at the same time. And he finds a way to focus his energy, his emotional loss, into something that which is constructive. And then I was sharing that with a friend. He told me, oh, well, there's this castle in Florida. And I got to digging on it. Turns out that it's true. And effectively, very briefly at a high level, what I recall is that this castle is built with these massive stones that are too heavy to really be moved using modern technology at the time, which was in the early 1900s or late 1800s, somewhere in there.
Yeah, early 1900s, that's correct.
And he did this building of this site all by himself. And residents of the area said he was very secretive. He wouldn't build during the day where people could watch. When they did get a chance to see him building this thing or working, they said they heard strange noises and they saw him levitating rocks and moving them with just pushing them with his hand. And ultimately, for whatever reason, I've totally forgotten the reason why, he ended up having to move the castle from one site to another. And he hired a trucker to come in and basically gave him some money, said, go away, come back in a couple of hours, go have a bite to eat. I don't care. I'll load the truck. And the trucker goes away, comes back, and he sees the guy basically levitating the final rock onto the bed of the pickup, or excuse me, the semi, and that's that. Now, there's legends that the FBI and government agencies came to see him, to talk to him. Ultimately, nobody knows how he did this, and there are prime numbers all riddled throughout the facility, and he basically said two things, just to paraphrase it. I figured out how the Egyptians did the pyramids, and if you figure out the prime numbers, you'll understand how I did it.
Wow, that's fascinating. And you hit everything. I'll just fill in some of the dates and names. Now, of course, for our story, we'll change the names. This, you know, we just use this as a jumping off point. This is just the factual part of it. His name is Edward Leedskalnin. I hope I said that right, you know. Not quite sure how to pronounce it, but it looks like it's Leedskalnin, Edward Leedskalnin, I guess. He was born in 1887. He was constructing this Coral Castle, finished it in 1923 around Florida City. And then in 1936, he decided to move the castle. And let's see, he moved it to Miami. So it went from Florida City to Miami. And what William said was correct. He had a broken heart. He had a 16-year-old fiance who broke his heart and rejected him just one day before the wedding. And this happened back in Latvia, before Edward came here to America. So he came from Latvia with a broken heart, and this is where he built the Coral Castle. Now, I feel like for our story, you know, again, we're not using Edward, the real Edward. We're going to make a fictional guy. I don't know what we'd name him, but our idea is just going to be that this heartbroken man builds this weird coral castle. Assuming you're not in your car driving right now and you're just sitting down listening to us, it'd probably be a good time to Google the Coral Castle and you can see what it looks like. It'll come up pretty easily. So we've got this guy, this heartbroken man building the Coral Castle. And I would say he was in love with a mermaid and the mermaid taught him how to do this weird levitation or whatever he did to make the Coral Castle. And somehow he's trying to get her back. What do you guys think?
So before we jump into the fictional part of this, the one thing I do want to jump out there is modern science is discovering and has now for a little bit of some time, okay, that we can control and levitate objects using sound, and we can move them around, we can turn them, mm-hmm. rotate them depending upon the frequencies of stuff. So this is all stuff that's happening in a laboratory. You can go out on YouTube and search levitation and sound, and it's there. So there is legitimate reason to believe that this is a viable technology that our esteemed friend Edward had knowledge of, but just wouldn't share. And now, mm-hmm. almost 100 years later, right, we are scientifically being able to catch up to him.
Yeah, and before I forget it, as we get caught up in our story, that one of the reports said that the witnesses saw Edward singing to the stones to move them. So that's the sound moving him.
And we have, there was a thought. This is, Edward was doing this about the same time as you had Tesla running around.
Mm, good point, yeah.
So you've got Edison, Tesla, and this Edward guy all in the space of where our modern understanding of electromagnetism and stuff started. And then you've got Spears with the God Machine a few years earlier.
So they were all part of the same secret society, you're saying.
So now we're jumping over into the fictional side, folks. So Jesse, why don't you take it from here?
So I like the sound concept, but I also like taking it into the Nikola Tesla realm as well, and thinking about magnetics as a way to levitate things, because you can use strong magnets to create really strong forces. So that's another way of doing it, and it would create, if you had a large set of electronics at the time, it would create probably a weird singing type sound. So that's where my head just starts off with.
Okay, so we know mermaids are often associated with using songs to attract sailors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if our esteemed builder using technology and sounds is doing this and attracts a mermaid?
I think we can do that, or the mermaid taught him the art of the magic singing, one or the other.
So if we go down the idea that the mermaid taught this gentleman how to sing to a stone to move it, right, then we could tie in the lost city of Atlantis, if you want to consider the lost city of Atlantis as being, say, an underwater ancient legend that Plato talked about.
Yeah, and maybe the Atlanteans became mermaids.
Well, there you go. They actually biohacked themselves, knowing that this volcano was about to erupt, that their whole civilization had nowhere to go but underground. So they biohacked themselves into mermaids to be able to continue living.
Yeah, Jesse, you're the biohacker guy. What do you think of that? How would you twist it?
Sounds like fun. Now, if they were to biohack themselves, I would want to maintain my ability to keep legs on land and swim in the ocean as well. So, that would potentially increase the overlap with the mermaid and the on land building. He could be the mermaid.
Oh, good idea.
Okay. Physiologically speaking, idea pops into my head. Kangaroo, the big pouch, okay? And those toys that you like, the toys that can like change shape, okay? What if the pouch has like the human legs and this creature has both fins and the fish side of things? And then when the creature wants to, they like, waddle themselves up onto the shore and then out comes the human legs and in goes the mermaid part. And it's, they biohack themselves. So, or they can just straight up morph. Okay. I don't know if we want to go either way, but still, from a physiological standpoint, I'm like imagining this creature and what it might look like.
I'm not gonna lie, William, that sounds pretty gross. Doesn't sound like Splash with what was it, Bo Derek and Splash, or Daryl, who was it in Splash? What was her name? Really cute blonde. What was it, Daryl Hannah or Bo Derek, or I can't remember the girl from Splash. But anyways, I think in Splash she dried out and her legs like magically appeared or something.
I like the pouch idea, and I would riff off of that and say that nobody ever saw his legs because he always wore pants, and nobody ever saw his feet, and that they were covered in scales and malformed in some way that could be hidden, and then that might also explain his cut off marriage, his fiance finding out about his legs.
There we go. She runs away because she thinks he's a freak.
Yeah.
And this is at a time period, right, where the idea of having some form of physical disability or abnormality is considered a curse to the progeny. And so she loves the guy. She doesn't want to turn him into, say, like, the exterminators. Okay. But she says, no, I'm not going to be the mother of your children. And, at the time, that's largely what marriage was the institution for propagation. Okay. So he comes to America. He's a mermaid slash real individual. So the Atlanteans are running around within humanity. They're just very well hidden.
Yeah.
Okay. And he ends up, out of a broken heart, using his ability and understanding of the geophysics of the world to move large stones and create this memorial for her.
Okay, so my mind's going somewhere now. It's finally, the creative spark is finally really hitting me. So you took me by surprise when you made the main guy character the mermaid. I like the idea of surprising our audience with that as well. So my idea is we can't see the story through his point of view. So, like, I don't want the audience to know that he's a mermaid. So here's what I see. In the 1920s, you've got the spiritualist movement kind of going on where people are interested in mysteries and things like that. So I see we've got a female reporter who's kind of into the spiritualist stuff, and she's trying to dig out the truth. And she formulates a story in her head, investigating him, that he fell in love with a mermaid. That's what she's thinking. Oh, he fell in love with a mermaid, and he must have learned how to do these weird things from the mermaids. And so that's what the audience will then also believe. And then we flip that on its ear when we learn, no, he is the mermaid all along.
That's cool. Yeah, that's a really cool thought, and it brings up a bunch of different types of conflict between his not wanting to be discovered and her tenacity for discovering what's really going on.
Yeah, and I think we expect a man to fall in love with a pretty mermaid. I don't think we expect a pretty girl to fall in love with a merman. So that would totally flip it.
Yeah. So I like running down this particular line of thought and the plot. The genre I think that this would really fit well in is a down-to-earth romance genre
Yeah.
mixed in with kind of that Pulp Fiction type. I mean, we're dealing with mermaids, so we have to
Yeah.
be able to create a believable world around the mythology. Okay. But we don't need fancy sci-fi and everything else in this. We can really just nail down the dynamics and do a commentary on the beauty of love, even in the presence of abnormalities or social constructs that would otherwise ostracize people from each other. And that then ties into the fact that he's got this fiance. He's deeply in love with her. She rejects him. So that's the prelude to the story. Mm-hmm. Then overcomes him to the States. We've got this reporter who's tracking down, say, mermaid sightings or whatever, and she's doing research. Maybe she's part of the Smithsonian. There we go.
Yeah.
Nice.
She's part of the Smithsonian. This mermaid gets shipped into the Smithsonian from that sighting you read at the beginning of the episode. He's or she is in this glass, you know,
glass case, I think.
With formaldehyde or whatever.
Dead. It's right. Dead, so it can't communicate, so it's just kind of an object.
So she's a Smithsonian researcher, and she's also got, say, all of these other mermaid sightings and Atlantis artifacts or whatever. And so she's trying to figure out what's going on. She's part of the Secret Society of Investigating the Paranormal. Okay. Maybe she's part of the John LeMay Secret Society. Who knows? So she goes down to Florida to investigate this guy who's building this castle. And through that process, she effectively falls in love with him. And during the stages of that courtship that or relationship or whatever, right? You know, he's standoffish because he doesn't want to get his heart broken again. And as she digs deeper, you know, that conflict is really about taking down those emotional barriers between two people.
That's good. You always got to have that underlying deeper meaning to it.
Yeah, he has to come to grips with that he can actually be loved.
Yeah, and the resolution of the story has to be that she, the Smithsonian investigator, fulfills what his fiance didn't. She accepts him, and maybe it's the inverse of the ending of Splash, because at Splash, Daryl Hannah takes Tom Hanks under the water, and I think he becomes a mermaid with her somehow. I'm just remembering, maybe I'm wrong, but in this case, maybe he would take her to Atlantis or something, and maybe the Coral City is his miniature recreation of Atlantis that he's homesick for, or maybe it's a tragic ending where the government kills him or the bad guy kills him or whatever. So, oh, lots of possibilities.
Maybe he can't leave something behind because he needs to survive on land. He needs something that is in the Coral Castle to survive on land.
Yeah.
So he builds it, and then when he moves, he has to move the castle as well, or he would die.
That would provide the motivation for the moving of the castle. A very good one, like too. It. Yeah. So we have the potential for obviously a trilogy, a series of books around the return of Atlantis. And we kind of touched on this in one of our other episodes, right, where we had those clam flying saucers, I believe, and they were dropping notes to people in the 1800s about the return of Atlantis. John, do you remember that episode?
I do not remember that episode. No. We come up with so many crazy things.
I know, right? This is episode
20-something.
Regardless, the thought is we've hit on Atlantis a couple of times now, so we could use this as like that, you know, book one, the discovery that Atlanteans still exist. That's the reveal in book one. Book two is, you know, he goes back to Atlantis to try to convince them that, hey, humans might not be so bad after all. And that's where you could say the reason Atlantis fell off the face of the planet in the first place was either A, they just got sick and tired of Homo sapiens, or B, there was a war between Homo sapiens and Atlanteans, and Homo sapiens basically wiped them off the face of the planet, or thought they did, right? And so the return of Atlantis is kind of like, you know, well, maybe there's a peaceable solution after all, you know? Then book three might be, you know, that actual return.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Jesse?
I really like that concept. You know, make it a trilogy where you have this fantasy, you have this romance, and the romance keeps the characters bound and provides, you know, the ability to try to push the Atlanteans into trying to accept at least some humans are good, just the way that he had to accept that some humans might love him, and that there was actually still love among Homo sapiens.
Yeah. There is a lot to work with here. Of course, there's a lot to work with everything. That's the process of the creative mind.
Yeah.
So we are out of time for today's episode, folks. We have very much enjoyed having you with us here. William Atkinson.
John LeMay.
And Jesse F. Lawrence on the phone. Thank you for your time, Jesse. Why don't you give us a little bit of a teaser on your books and your socials?
Yeah, so my books are generally sci-fi with a bit of dystopian component to them. iNano deals with nanites that Quake can control. Day After Infinity is a space opera of sorts, and Metal, everything starts to rust and what happens then. You can find me online at JFL here as in H-E-R-E on most social networks, from Twitter to Reddit to Instagram.
Excellent. Today, we thought we were going to take a spring break trip, and we ended up on a whole Atlantean legend.
Yeah, whole nother continent.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. I love how these episodes just really out there sometimes. And sometimes we end up with a down-to-earth story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, folks, out of time today. Again, Jesse, thank you for your time and spending the afternoon with us.
It was great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we'll look forward to doing it again someday. In the meantime, William Atkinson,
John LeMay,
with Jesse F. Lawrence. I'll leave links in the description for his books on Amazon, as well as Audible, and you can get them on Kindle, Kindle Unlimited, etc. And we'll also provide links to his social media platforms where applicable. If you have suggestions for the show, send us an email to submissions@plotpit.com. If you're interested in potentially being on the program, let us know. I mean, we are also spinning up content for distribution on YouTube, and we are about to launch a live stream channel for Twitch, so stay tuned for more details on that. I keep teasing it. It will come out soon. It might even be out by the time this episode airs. We also have a Discord server. If you want to join, send me an email at submissions@plotpit.com. I'll send you an invite link, or just hit me up on Twitter. That will be plotpit. Right there, just at PlotPit. Jesse, you are on our Discord server, so if you are interested in sending out invites to any of your fan base, please do so.
Great, will do.
And for our folks who are potentially interested in interacting with Jesse, you can do that on our Discord server. In the meantime, William Atkinson,
John LeMay,
and Jesse F. Lawrence, again, thank you for your precious time today.
It was my pleasure.
I believe that's the end of the episode, John.
Yeah.
Next week, what do we got?
Oh, I don't know. It's a mystery.
Tune in next week to find out. All right, folks. We'll catch you around.